Exactly, and people would go and they would observe how the poor were living, and I mean, but I think people were aware of it. But in the same way, I mean, there's a very strong parallel to be drawn today, because in the same way that, you know, we are aware that there's a homeless crisis going on,
Yes.
but are we really aware of what that
Yes.
means?
Yeah.
Welcome to Sex Power Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. Hallie Reubenhold is a social historian and an authority on women's lives in the past. We're discussing her book, The Five, an incredibly well-researched and eye-opening insight into the lives of the women who were murdered by Jack the Ripper. Today we're going to be talking about poverty and addiction. We're going to be talking about the history of trafficking, the shame and stigma around women with unconventional lives, and the similarities between Victorian London and today.
So you must have done something to be there. They think that people are at fault.
They're morally defective.
Yes.
This is the whole idea behind the workhouse, you know, and the fact that if you were poor, somehow you had failed on a personal level.
Yes.
And if you were relying on the state, if you were relying basically on the parish for support, then there was something wrong with you.
Yeah.
And you had to be shown that you couldn't do this, that this wasn't going to be a fun experience. Otherwise, they believed people would just all be idle and they didn't do anything, much like today.
Yes,
you know?
They do believe that people just become so lazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they wanted to make the workhouse the worst possible experience it could be.
Yeah. And it was like it was punishment. That's one of the things from your book that was just so awful. The idea that you would have to be so desperate to actually go, and they made you stay overnight. So they made it so inconvenient for people.
The casual ward, the whole system of the casual ward was set up so that if people found themselves without accommodation, it was meant to cut back or cut down on vagrancy. So people sleeping rough and not having anywhere to go. So they could go to the casual ward. And the casual ward was like a wing of the workhouse. And you could get one night accommodation there in exchange for work. But what they eventually found is that they had to hold people over for a full day to do work, and then they had to stay a second night. And the experience was awful. You know, it was exploitative. The food was appalling. The conditions in which people slept, the dormitories were horrific, full of vermin.
Yeah.
And again, this was to put people off. But what we know now about that is that, you know, people's souls just become completely wrung out by these experiences.
Yeah, eroded.
Yeah, and they become depressed, and then you can't help yourself.
Yeah, well, that was the very interesting thing with the relationship with alcohol and obviously people having a really horrifically terrible time. The women you're writing about in your book, was it all five of them had kind of alcoholism?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's obviously this intersection. But I want to ask you, because we were talking about it just outside, and I think it's so interesting. So your book is about the five, what they call them, the canonical five victims of Jack the Ripper, and it's concentrating on them and their lives and their biography and details that lots of people, including myself, who think they know lots about Jack the Ripper and 1888, will find really surprising in terms of their background. So you said you've had pushback from Ripperologists.
Yes,
yeah.
Quite a lot. It's really, you know, I expected, obviously, that there would be some controversy around this book because, you know, it's a subject that a lot of people think they know a lot about, is very much part of our culture. And when you question some of those aspects of the cultural mythology, people tend to get a bit iffy about it and sniffy about it. And the Ripperologists have a kind of sense of ownership over this story.
Yeah.
And they feel that because they've spent X amount of years sifting through papers and reading each other's books, that somehow, you know, they are the oracle.
Yes.
And how dare I bypass them and write this? And obviously, whatever I've written can't be true. But more to the point, the fact that I'm questioning what they consider fact.
Yeah, so an interesting detail, I thought. I thought it was so fascinating, because this is what I think is really interesting, having read the same kind of story over and over again. So I'm pretty sure it's Polly with the hat.
So, yes, the jolly bonnet.
Yes, so and there's this quote that's always been used as evidence that she was about to go out and have sex for money, because she didn't have money for the Doss house. And she says, "Of course I'm going to have enough money. Look how pretty my bonnet is." And And you point out that quite often people pawned their clothes or anything, and that it would make much more sense because there wasn't, she wasn't selling sex all the time. There isn't any evidence for that. It was a narrative created by the media at the time that there was someone killing prostitutes. So she was killed by them. She must be a prostitute. There's lots of things we can't ever know for definite, especially when it's historically. It's really surprising that someone doesn't want to consider, no, she was definitely going out to have sex. She couldn't possibly just be pawning her hat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's... And the other thing which is really interesting about that is it's actually even questionable whether that was ever even said by her.
Yes.
And, you know, that appears in a newspaper. And again, if, you know, all of these things, if you look at 10 different versions of 10 different newspapers... Mm. We will get 10 different versions of what was supposedly said.
So their sources at the time would have been people who said that they were there, and that could have been anyone. So even nowadays, if someone says a source close to Victoria Beckham, we know that doesn't mean anything's happening in her marriage.
Exactly, that's right. You know, so I think this idea that because it appeared in a newspaper, we can take it as fact, or even one of the other things I take issue with are the witness statements.
Yes.
And this is a real problem because, first of all, what we know are, there were 5 inquests into the 5 deaths, and where the coroner considered all of the evidence, and there were witnesses that were brought before the coroner's court, and there was a jury, and all of this was reported and recorded. However, there are only 2 official sets of documents that exist, and the rest are reported in the newspapers.
And that's what exists, not the actual documents from the inquest.
The newspaper version exists, but in 3 of the cases, the newspaper version exists.
Yeah.
In 2 of the cases, we have the actual documentation. The interesting thing, that's one layer of inconsistency that we have to deal with. And then the next one is what it is exactly that the witnesses saw and how reliable is this stuff? Because what we understand today about how witnesses interpret crimes, you know, how the psychology of what witnesses are experiencing.
Yeah, and how often they're just very wrong and it feels real to them. So it's not,
it's
no one's
changed.
Intentionally lying.
Yeah.
But the memory itself kind of shifts things together to make them make more sense or suggestibility.
Exactly.
Saying what someone looks like, suddenly you can remember them dashing across and...
Exactly. Yeah. And we know, for example, we know that has changed tremendously. And also, the sets of guidelines which have been introduced subsequently into the law, the way the law actually regards witness testimony vis-a-vis what we have learned since 1888. Mm. So to go back and look at witness testimony and say, well, we know that that person experienced it, that's a fact. Well, we don't know that. We somebody saw or heard something. We don't know that that was pertinent to the murder at all.
Yeah.
So this idea that these witness statements given by people who did not physically actually talk to the victims prior to their death or actually know them or be able to identify them, that can be thrown out because that's unreliable.
It would be now.
If a case
was being made now, there would be irrelevant information.
Yes.
I think I saw a woman.
Yes, exactly.
Probably was that. It was around that kind of time. That kind of any vague area, and you'd go, "This is nothing. You give us nothing."
Yes, exactly.
You saw a person. I believe that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is one of the things that reparologists take issue with, is the fact that I'm saying, but the witness statements, you cannot just take that at face value.
It's interesting because you're pulling apart in a really fascinating way what we should be questioning, but they're like, I've built a solid living on that.
Exactly.
So don't pull it away from me.
More than that, they've built a solid identity on that.
Okay, yeah.
And it's this idea of, I'm a reparologist. This is how I identify myself. It's almost like belonging to a football club.
Yeah. Are they mostly men?
The majority are men. There are some women.
There are some women, yes.
And for them, so we circle back to this whole thing about them being prostitutes.
Yes.
So... Well, the one fact that reparology has always been able to agree on in this world of very grey area facts, and they even argue amongst themselves, is that Jack the Ripper killed prostitutes.
Yes.
And if you take that away, you take away You question everything,
yes,
really.
So this is, so you kind of point out in your book that this is a narrative that was created by the press after the first murder.
Yes.
Straight away. And it's very interesting because obviously people killing prostitutes hasn't stopped, but the easiest comparison is with the Yorkshire Ripper, because he killed some prostitutes and assaulted and attempted to murder other prostitutes, but also women who had never sold sex work. Mm. And one of the biggest problems in finding him was they had already created a narrative where he was angry with women who sold sex.
Yes.
And they used that horrible phrase about when they eventually realised, oh, killed prostitutes and innocent women.
Yes.
And some of the victims, they then looked for the sex work they had done to prove their theory.
Yeah.
Very similarly. And so that's one of the things I think that's most important in going back to Jack the Ripper as this like earliest serial killer, the most famous and iconic, and something we've all just grown up with, which is some women deserve it. So it's street cleansing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then to go back right to the very beginning and rub that out and go,
yeah,
some women are vulnerable. So
yes,
some women are drunk asleep on the floor.
Yeah.
So do you want to outline that for anyone who hasn't read your book yet? So some of the women, so presumably they were very quiet, these murders. People didn't,
yes,
hear people screaming and running around and fighting back.
That was, okay, so there are a lot of things about these murders which people don't realise. First of all, Jack the Ripper didn't have sex with the victims.
No.
And a lot, yeah, of people think, well, hang on, I thought these were sex crimes.
People assume it's a sexual interaction in,
exactly,
resulting in a death. Yeah.
Exactly. And there was absolutely no evidence of this. I mean, I say these were gender crimes.
Yes.
These were crimes against women.
Yeah.
There were no signs of struggle, and there was no noise. Nobody reported hearing screams.
It's a very busy part of London, is the thing. Like buildings on either side. I've been,
yes,
on one of the walking tours, and while lots of the buildings aren't there, the thing is, they were so crowded, these
very
areas.
Very densely populated.
Yes, yeah.
And there were people out on the street at all times of the night.
Yes.
And a lot of these people were homeless people, and,
yeah,
they were, you know, walking about because they had nowhere else to stay.
Mm.
And there is much more evidence to suggest that three of the five women were sleeping rough when,
yes,
they were killed than soliciting. Actually, there is, for three of the five, there is absolutely zero proof they were soliciting.
I found that such a surprising,
yeah,
detail. All of this story that ran in when there wasn't any.
Yes,
there,
yeah,
isn't a story. We,
yeah,
don't know. So let's build one in,
yes,
there.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, let's draw a number of, you know, assumptions,
mm,
from our prejudices.
Yes.
So, you know, much like the case of the Yorkshire Ripper,
mm,
you know, the Yorkshire Ripper, everybody assumed, well, you know, he was killing prostitutes.
Yes.
It's the same sort of thing. The Victorian mind conflated the broken woman and the fallen woman.
Yes. Something else I hadn't realised, that not being with your husband or having any kind of familial relationship with another man, you were the same as a prostitute anyway.
They, yes,
were all, everyone was lumped together.
Yes, that's
in,
right.
Yes.
You were a moral failure.
Mm.
And, you know, you were leading what was called an irregular life.
Yeah.
So an irregular life was, you know, you had no fixed abode. You were separated from your husband and your family.
Mm.
You may have been an alcoholic, you know, the same applied to women with mental illness.
Mm.
Any woman who went off the path of what was expected,
mm,
of a Victorian woman at the time, which was basically to be a wife and a mother and a carer.
Yes, yeah.
And so they were morally deficient. And, you know, any woman out on the street at night in the worst part of town, at that time, and even 100 years later,
yes,
in Yorkshire,
yes,
was thought to be a prostitute.
Yeah, and I guess the prostitute is just a catch-all for kind of like a deviancy,
yes,
a form of being a societal deviant. And it then meant that respectable, and I put that in quotation marks, respectable women of the time don't have to be scared of this murderer, because isn't it another way of kind of keeping women in their place?
That's
in,
right,
the home?
Yes.
Is, well, actually, if you become a deviant, if you deviate from what society expects of you, then when you're prey all,
yes,
of a sudden.
Yeah. And also, you know what? It's a way in which women can actually enforce the patriarchy as well,
yes,
because it's the women who buy into it also. So,
yeah,
women say, it's not just men saying, well, you know, you have to stay at home now.
Mm.
It's women saying, well, I'm a good woman.
Yes.
I'm not out on the street at night. I don't have to,
yes,
worry about this,
yeah,
sort of thing.
It happens even now. The different kind of, it's when So you know the kind of woman, especially she might be an older woman. I remember when Joanna Lumley did this, not to attack her personally, but to say, these girls who go out and get drunk at parties, what do they expect?
Mm.
This idea that actually we have to police our own safety.
Yes.
And if you transgress that by being drunk or wearing a short skirt or no knickers, well, there you go then.
Yes.
You're complicit.
In your own downfall.
Yes.
Well, I mean, that persists. It's really interesting because two of the things I mention in the conclusion of my book, first of all, is the Suffolk Strangler case, where the judge, this was about 10 years ago, and the judge felt in his summing up that one of the things he had to say to instruct the jury to leave aside their prejudices about the women that this man killed, he said, well, lay aside your feelings about whatever drugs they took, whatever their lifestyle was. These women did not deserve to be murdered.
Yeah.
And the fact that in the modern era,
you have to remind people of that.
That we have to remind people.
The stigma around sex in general, but the extreme amount if someone is selling sex, and obviously with the Suffolk Strangler, that was definitely the case with these women, is people do have such an other that they can't see that they know people who have sold sex, that there are people who have sold sex in the public eye. It doesn't suddenly make you a different kind of human being or a human being without worth. They're very, and it's what's interesting, tracing kind of Jack the Ripper through to that judge having to say that. The press still talks about sex workers in a horrific way, in a dehumanising way. It's rent boys or it's, the most horrific crime could happen to someone. They could be cut up in bin bags. But if they've ever sold sex, the language around them, it would be...
Well, it's really interesting even thinking about Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels, what came out surrounding that. You know, this idea, we can't put any credibility behind what Stormy Daniels is saying because, basically she's a prostitute.
Yes,
she works in the adult entertainment industry.
Yeah, completely devalued.
Yeah.
There's a big thing with porn workers, actually, in terms of becoming mainstream, like having mainstream credibility. And a few people have managed it. And it's such a rare thing because once you have sold sex in any form, society wants to malign you. Like that's why they have such a strong separate community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can completely see that. And I think it will take quite a long time before we completely exorcise our demons around sex work. I think the first step is we have to legalize it.
Absolutely.
Only way to go.
I think it's something that I'm talking about a lot on these podcasts to activists, sex worker activists, is because I think lots of people, myself included, are quite ignorant of many things but well-meaning, and you can be ignorant, you can really mean well and think, well, all I know about sex work is the horrific crimes or the vulnerability. You hear about the worst, most emotive things, and then you want to protect people and you don't realise you just endanger the people without any kind of suggestion or solution of how else to earn your money or all of those kind of things. And it's interesting that can all be traced back to these early crimes as well. When I had originally thought or believed, based on information from other books, that there's these five prostituted women, and then Jack the Ripper killed them. But because of the economics, there are women who would have been so scared at the time, but they couldn't just stop how they earned money. There were women who were prostitutes.
Yeah.
They didn't just stop going out to work.
Yeah.
And the difficulty now when there are dangers is... when something isn't legal, people are incredibly vulnerable. And actually, when, punters are scared or they don't want to be caught, you force women into darker car parks, more dangerous situations, having less autonomy and choice about the situation.
Yes, and that's what legalisation hopefully would bring an end to.
Yes, yeah, and be a first step of it. And so in terms of them, I wanted to ask, so one of the victims of Jack the Ripper originally came from Sweden.
Yes.
And I had no idea that that was her background. And also, it was actually the most tragic thing in the book for me to read about, was that she had some kind of sexual experience, and then the law in Sweden, which we now think is such a kind of liberal country, the law was that she had to go for these mandatory kind of pelvic examinations with a gynecologist, and then if you had an STD, they imprisoned you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was horrific. I mean, it was so unfortunate for Elizabeth Stride, because I suspect it's very difficult to figure out, you know, how she found herself in this, in the circumstances she did, other than the fact that she was working as a servant, we know, at the time. And there are so many cases that it's almost a trope of Victorian life, of, you know, the servant getting pregnant by the master or by somebody within the household. It's almost certain that that's what would have happened. What happened? I mean, it's such an unfortunate set of circumstances for her, because what happened around that time also was that Sweden had brought in these laws regulating prostitution. And it meant that if you were suspected of being a prostitute, you went on a list, and there was another list for those who were well known. And the ones who were suspected, so women, so single women who were pregnant, women who stayed out at night by themselves, women with not great reputations, if they go on that list, you know, men's mistresses, things like that, if they go on that list, then they are then treated like the well-known sex workers. And so those women can't get work that's legitimate.
So they're
forced into the sex trade in that way. So Elizabeth Stride found herself in a situation where she was pregnant with another man's child at 7 months. It's unknown whether that, well, I mean, that man obviously disappeared at some point. It's unknown whether that man was also the man who gave her syphilis, which she was found to have when she went for her mandatory examination. And she was put in the Lock Hospital, or the Cahoosit, as it was called. And she was treated, and she miscarried at 7 months.
So you can't help, even before the miscarriage, there's so much misery there, but created by society, not created by her. There's nothing wrong with getting pregnant. There actually is nothing wrong with having syphilis if it's curable, treatable, all of those things.
But it wasn't at the time.
Well, it's pretty bad to have syphilis then. Probably it's still probably very bad to have it now. But yeah, but the misery is, as you say, that catch 22, just being sexual as a woman. And also, I can't help it, and again, it's modern sensibility. I'm sure lots of sex at the time was consensual and people had exactly the same desires as now.
Exactly.
But with the power dynamic, whenever you have a servant woman getting pregnant, all of my hackles rise in terms of the behaviour of men who essentially had women dependent on them and trapped in their houses.
Exactly.
I can't think of anything worse than having a male employer who lives in the house. And I guess we've seen kind of fictional representations of... But I read that book at university. They made us read Pamela.
Oh, God, yes.
And we and we actually, because what year would this have been? 2004.
She marries a rapist.
Yes, we couldn't believe this squire who just attempted to rape her every day and locked her in an attic, and she kept fainting from fear and writing letters to her parents. And eventually he respects her so much that she was able to fight him off, that he marries her. And it's a romantic story about stop letting men rape you, women, and then they'll just respect you more and you can be their wife. So disgusting.
Yeah.
So that's how I think of all of that, all of those situations where there are women pregnant. And I really hope that's not a denial of female sexuality. I know sometimes women love sex. And I hope that that's very true of Swedish servants in the 19th century.
I think you're absolutely right to, you know, to pinpoint that that particular aspect of the abuse of power, because that is what it was. And it was believed poor women were there to be used.
Yes.
And, you know, you referenced the 18th century and Pamela and, you know, Clarissa again is a similar thing. You know, that that poor women were there to be used. And that's very much, that runs all the way through the writings of the 18th and 19th century.
The first book I read about Jack the Ripper said that the reason that it was an important point in history was that women were starting to become unavailable to men, because women were starting to get, and I don't know if this theory is correct, by the way, but it was interesting to think about that. Women were starting to get work as kind of secretaries. And basically this book was saying there were always voiceless women that awful things happened to. And there was no recourse because they weren't somebody's, I guess, obviously rape for a long time was a crime of property rights against the man who was the owner, so usually like a father or a husband. So, but when women had their own autonomy, suddenly taking anything from them, and that's the beginning of sexual crimes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, Definitely. And it's interesting that you also mentioned, you know, there was recourse for if you were wealthy and your wife had sex with another man or your daughter had sex with another man, you could sue that man.
Yes.
That was called criminal conversation.
Yeah.
And there was in the 18th and early 19th centuries in this country, that was something which, you know, the aristocracy, the landed classes were, you know, very much caught up in this idea that somehow your wife was a piece of property.
Yes.
And that's how she was recognized in law at the time. She wasn't recognized as an individual.
No.
So you could get damages from your wife's lover. And so all of these trials came to court as a result of this. And, you know, the women were voiceless. The women weren't even allowed to give testimony in court.
No.
Because, you know, the belief was, well, you know, if somebody breaks a vase or, you know, kind of damages my horse, we don't bring them into court.
Yeah, the horse has got nothing to say on this.
Exactly.
Yeah, how could it be relevant? What I found so shocking was how up to so recently the cuckold defence for murder was people got off. Like, what else would you do?
Yeah.
You find your property, you find your horse in flagrante with somebody else, and it's your horse, you kill it.
Yes, well, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And also, you know, a lot of, if you look at how women are written about, women who have been murdered in murders where a husband murders a wife, even into the 20th century, and I'm thinking of the Crippen murder in particular, how the press looks at, like, Dr. Crippen murdered his wife and buried her in the cellar.
Okay.
You know, part of what the press was talking about was, well, you know, I mean, she was a really sort of brash musical performer.
Oh, yes.
She was asking for it. She pushed him. She was she henpecked
him.
Yeah,
nagging is a thing that comes up a lot with kind of nagging wives.
Yeah.
As if that's a kind of form of domestic abuse that a man eventually snaps.
Yes.
And goes, stop telling me to put the bins out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So a woman makes him do it.
Yes. So to go back to Sweden, and this kind of, so these forced examinations. And so Elizabeth Stride then was put into a hospital. She miscarried because of the syphilis. We had a thing in this country for a long period of time, the Contagious Diseases Act, which was very similarly used against, I guess, any sexual women. But the premise was prostitutes were blamed for STDs rather than any kind of... they always wanted to protect soldiers, didn't they?
That's right.
Young men. And so the women selling sex were blamed for spreading diseases.
That's right. It was firmly placed on the women's shoulders, as it was in Sweden as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole point. So the Contagious Diseases Act was brought in somewhat at about a similar time to when these laws were brought in into Sweden.
Mm.
And they mainly affected... port towns,
yes.
Because, as you mentioned, it was to protect the soldiers and the sailors. And but, you know, the blame for the spreading of this disease was firmly placed on the women's shoulders. You know, the men were free to come and go. And, you know, what kind of underpins this is this idea that male sexuality can't be contained, whereas women should contain
they're the gatekeepers
sexuality.
Of it.
Yes.
Yes.
And there's something wrong with them if they don't contain their sexuality. Mm. And it's the women who are the deviants, not the men. You know, you expect, you know, soldiers are hot-blooded and, you know, and
they have needs that need to be out there. Well, this is also quite one of the very negative presumptions about prostitutes and sex workers is the idea that, well, men are going to have to do it anyway the prostitutes kind of take a hit for society.
Yes, like that's right. Sacrificial lambs.
Yeah, in Victorian times and previous to that as well. But the idea was that's how all the rest of the women remain so pure.
Yes, in fact, it's very interesting because a lot was written in the 18th century about this idea about maintaining the purity of upper class women by having these poor women who were naturally thought to be more sexualized and that they didn't have manners and they didn't have refined sentiment, they didn't have refined feelings, and so therefore this was a necessary evil. This whole kind of layer of women who could be sexually exploited in order to make sure that the daughters and the wives and the sisters of men of property were kept pure.
Yes.
It's repulsive.
Yes. It's really wrong on both senses. Obviously there's a complete denial of female sexuality anyway.
Yes.
But then the idea that it's a male right, the male sex right, And it has to go somewhere.
Yes.
And so let's keep our own fertility over here safe and unsullied so we know who the land is going to next.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it, yes, so it's obviously all about preserving the integrity of inheritance, you know, because if you marry a woman who you have no idea, you know, if she, well, if she's been with another man and you have a question about her, what was called virtue or her virginity, you don't know if, when you take her to the altar, if she is actually carrying another man's child.
Yes.
So somebody else's issue is going to inherit your long line of family property.
Yeah. So in nature, that the whole, they call it paternity certainty. And the thing is that mammals don't have it because we just take internally. And as human beings became more and more cognitive, they became more and more aware of something instinctual, which was, mate guarding, essentially. And that's why we fetishize virginity, this idea that this is, you definitely know if you can protect. And it's interesting, it's a whole theory about hebephilia, where men are attracted, heterosexual men are attracted to kind of teenage girls. That the idea, if you got somebody on the cusp of puberty, that was how you ensured paternity certainty and things like that. Because obviously that's the other thing, is that people were getting married much younger.
Yes, yeah they were. Mm. But I mean, you know, it is also really important to point out that in terms of sexual morality, it really was a case of one set of beliefs and practices for one part of society and another set of beliefs and practices for another set of society. And where property was involved, especially in the 18th and 19th centuries, you know, this idea of the kind of integrity of the wife was really important. But if you look at the majority of society, and that is the poor, you know, the lower middle classes, that virginity was not seen as being so sacrosanct because it didn't matter as much. And so there is a lot of discussion about this. I mean, in terms of, obviously there is, in the 19th century, there's very much a moral imperative, and the 18th century, you know, with regard to Christianity and, you know, personal purity. But there is this idea. So, you know, the middle classes, when they start trying to come to terms with the poor, the urban poor, and that they don't understand, you know, how the poor see themselves and their own morality vis-a-vis what the established norm is.
Yes.
So, like, for example, you know, we know that young women had sex outside of marriage quite a lot in poorer classes.
Yes.
And often a woman would get pregnant and then she'd get married.
Mm.
Or, you know, there was no guarantee that child would be brought to term, that child would even be born alive.
Yes.
And so this idea that everybody in the 19th century was pure and then only had sex after marriage is complete rubbish.
We have, 'cause I guess that's what we have, is this received idea that everyone was very sexually uptight, whereas actually no, sexuality really existed in exactly the same way. It was just what it was conventional to talk about.
And also, you know, I think the one thing that we tend to skate over a lot, because it does not factor so much in our lives, though it is still very much present, is shame. Shame around sexuality.
Yeah.
And that's one thing, like, especially in all of these women's stories, you know, the shame was so acute in the past. Shame around your own sexuality.
And
as
also
a woman.
Shame that then reflects on your entire family.
Yes.
Because that was what was quite interesting, is that, so say for instance, like you were describing, it was very common for people to have, because especially if marriage itself was an expensive institution, you'd then need your own rooms and space. And so people maybe having sex, but that with all of these five victims, their lifestyle choices reflected on everybody around them.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and so, and actually that's one of the things that I tried to show in my book, is, you know, what their deaths actually meant, but what their suffering meant as well, and what that meant for the family. And and there was this legacy of shame. What's quite interesting is, having met some of the descendants, is, you know, talking to them about, you know, their great grandparents, or their grandparents would never mention this.
Yeah.
That there was shame, obviously, that these women were defective women in some way, that they were immoral, obviously, with the story that they were prostitutes as well. That,
so rather than it being an awful tragedy.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's such a tragic thing to have in your family, to know that a relative a couple of generations before you is murdered.
Yeah.
But yeah, the idea that that's a stain on the family reputation. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how terrible, you know, the shame that person lived with in life and then the shame heaped upon them after death and the shame the family carries. Mm. I mean, I just think it's time to purge all of
absolutely. It has to be reassessed, because when we repeat ancient stories with exactly the same outcomes, where these are Jack the Ripper is cleansing the streets or prostitutes, and we're actually, each generation is learning the same kind of very out of date wrong morality, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
So I'm really interested in kind of one of the things I got reading your book is actually sometimes to be a poorer woman, not to be married, was much freer than being a married woman, actually kind of obeying society's rules. Like actually the only women with any autonomy are quite often those slightly outside of respectability.
Yes.
And whether that's, I know, the circus, the stage, and same for people who sold sex or sold their company.
Yes. Yeah. Or even, I was going to say, you know, back in the 18th century, there were a group of women who had been separated from their husbands or involved in scandal, who bound together and formed their own kind of society with one another.
Okay.
And the men, you know, of their own class could see them, but the women couldn't.
Oh.
And so, you know, there's this idea that, you know, if they were outside of respectability, and as soon as you step outside of respectability, and this is the thing, this is like, I suspect that, you know, people who wrote these moral tracts and, you know, instructional literature of the day were almost afraid that women would find this out.
Yes.
That, yes, in order to transition to the other side, in order to pass from respectable to a woman of no reputation, it was a really painful and horrible process. Mm. But when you got there, sometimes it wasn't bad.
Yes.
And you had freedom, but also you tended to find community with other people who were like you. And human beings being human beings, nobody completely ever ostracized that person entirely.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting, like going back to the 18th century, there was a woman, Lady Penelope Pitt, who was divorced from her husband. Mm. She had a really high-profile affair with an Italian poet.
Oh, wow.
And then there was this very interesting letter from her, which says, you know, it's kind of 15 years later, where she says, well, you know, I may have fallen from respectability and I lost all of this stuff that I had had before, but actually I'm much happier now.
Yes.
I'm happy with my own society and the few friends I have and my books and the things that I do than I would ever have been in that other world.
Yes.
And that's such a unique voice to hear, because you don't hear that. All you hear is, because we, you know, we read the literature of the time, the literature is full of this moralizing and the standard reinforcement of the norms, which were, you know, women toe the line and you're going to be miserable if you don't, and all the drama in the sort of fall from grace.
Yes.
But you'd never hear that story, because that was taboo to say that, because that's like anarchy.
Yeah, I think it is. That questions everything about the status quo, which is, if all of the rules are you do this and then you're happy or you get into heaven or some combination of that, and that's where your safety lies, for some to say, hey, actually, that might not be true.
Yeah.
That might be... and I think probably very often people outside of a convention see it far more clearly than those inside it, going, well, you do it because that's what you do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which are the kind of the rulings. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's you know, it's also interesting to note that in the 18th century, if a woman was, if she had inherited property or something, she was, there's the femme sole and the femme couvert. And the femme couvert is what happens when you get married. All of your property transfers to your husband.
Yes.
But the femme sole is sort of unattached. Mm. And so therefore, she can own property in a way that a married woman couldn't.
Yes.
So there was this almost kind of an incentive in that respect not to marry.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of, for example, Anne Lister,
who was
a lesbian the early 19th century. And, you know, she never married and she was a landowner.
Yes.
And,
well, it's so different if you're wealthy.
Yeah.
I mean, because money is autonomy. And if your money is yours, I guess then only if you wanted to have children would you have any need to marry. I mean, you'd be much better to be a lesbian or just to have female companions.
And a lot of women did. Mm. You know, there are stories of these women. And it's interesting because if you were born into a landed family, you know, often the father could see that the daughter might not be inclined to marry, or he could project and say, look, if there isn't going to be a man who's going to look after you, I'm going to leave X amount to you to make sure you're okay if you're a spinster.
Yeah.
And a lot of women, you know, led happy lives, though having said that, society totally ostracized spinsters. You know, it was a horrible thing to be.
Or a little bit of that even kind of carries on to the present day. It's interesting to trace these. People do lots of, you know, like jokes about cat women.
That's right. Crazy
cat lady. Because in themselves, by saying, hey, I am happy as I am, still questions that, no, we pair up.
Yes.
We breed.
Yes.
We watch Netflix.
Yes.
Like, there are all these things that we do. And for someone to go like, oh, me and this cat.
Actually really happy together.
Yeah, really happy. People, and that's a much, obviously, it's a much less restrictive, but there's still this social kind of thing of, even the way single people are always asked about dating. Have you met anyone? Are you on apps? How are you? What are you doing about this state you're in?
Why don't you have a boyfriend?
Yes, why don't you have a boyfriend? Or, yeah, both my sisters are younger than me and married, and at both weddings, you have people kind of go, oh, you next. We must all want the same thing, mustn't we?
Yes.
Yeah.
And life is inconceivable without, you know, even life is inconceivable without children.
Mm.
Being a married woman with no children.
Yes.
It's very, very similar.
Yes.
Why haven't you bred yet?
Well, the fact that people feel a need to ask, and again, you can have a legitimate version, which is, I've tried and they've all died.
Yes.
Or I'm this. Or
I sold them on eBay.
Yeah. you can have a version, but you better have a story that isn't, oh, I'm so fulfilled.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Because then what happens is, it is odd, I guess. Maybe that's the thing about subjectivity. We all want people to be the same, to reflect our needs. But the fact that people can't understand that what they desperately wanted, someone else doesn't care, or vice versa.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. I think it's especially interesting in terms of the restrictiveness of women's lives historically. And what still echoing on. The nature of addiction is very interesting with these five canonical women, because in their lives, as well as kind of reflecting the politics and morality of the time, you also have something that we still haven't worked out how to deal with, which is people who have substance abuse issues, or the most important thing, and it can be very cyclical with a very difficult life, or if you're poor, you can't afford your substance. There are very rich people who are able to take drugs every day.
Yes.
And they don't have to sleep rough. But the alcohol abuse with these women, the fact that they weren't allowed to drink when they went to the
casual ward,
workhouse. Yes,
I know. I think the person whose life most exemplifies that is Annie Chapman, because she really suffered. She seems to have inherited alcoholism from her father, who was an alcoholic and killed himself, and her brother also inherited alcoholism, and her sisters became teetotal, obviously seeing that there was some sort of connection here. It's interesting because by the end of the 19th century, people were able to identify the link between alcoholism and heredity.
Yes.
And so Annie was aware of this, and her brother was aware of this, and her sisters were aware of this. But Annie had an opportunity to have a much better life than she had. She certainly didn't even need to be on the streets.
I think that's what would surprise a lot of people about her story, is you just assume, even if it's through like a series of tragic accidents, that the women murdered by Jack the Ripper were already kind of in the very lowest of the lowest class. And as you point out so brilliantly, it's like she was pretty good. He worked with horses, her husband?
He was the head coachman for a gentleman on a country estate.
Yes.
And then it seems that he rose even further than that and became what's called a stud groom. So he actually bought the racing stock.
Yes.
And, you know, that position was a very coveted position, because it meant you had the ear of this gentleman and all of the whole racing society. And so that was quite a prestigious position. And they lived in their own cottage on the country estate outside of Windsor. But the problem was that Annie was an alcoholic. And she went into one of the first women's rehabilitation centres in this country and spent a year there.
And she was completely teetotal for that time.
And she was teetotal for that time, and she came back and things were going pretty well. And then at a certain point, she stumbled again. And then that's when I think, you know, sending her off to the rehab center was really like the last straw
of
for
course,
the family.
Yeah.
And so when she lapsed again, it was...
Again, it shows how loved she was, because to go to that extent, they were trying to save her from something that was hurting her, which is, I guess, quite a common trope for people who love an addict or are dealing with that, is they did everything they could up to the point of paying for this and missing her and not having her as part of the family life. It's a huge thing to send somebody away and for them to come back and go, okay, I've done a year and I'm ready and I can do this. And so it just shows you that someone can be absolutely loved, but if a circumstance, a personal circumstance, means they can't live a conventional life, then they can become slip into that vulnerability, which is what happened to her.
Yeah.
Because you kind of trace the events, don't you, from drinking again, having to leave, wanting to leave the family home. Where was she? She was in Notting Hill.
She was. So she, when she went back to stay with her family, so her family lived in Knightsbridge.
Yes.
And there is some connection. The question is, how did she get to Whitechapel? Because what we don't appreciate, I mean, a lot of people don't realise, you know, Whitechapel wasn't the only sink of poverty in London.
Yeah.
There were lots of pockets of poverty throughout the city. So if you were poor, you didn't just migrate over to Whitechapel.
Yeah.
And there's some suggestion that she had a relationship with a man from Notting Hill. And that was probably the way in which she ended up in Whitechapel, was following him there.
Yes,
because Notting Hill is very close to where her family lived. You know, so she just kept spiraling down. And at some point, you know, when she parted company with her sisters who were teetotal and who really wanted to help her, she said, you know, I can't do this anymore. It's just the drink. I have to have the drink.
Yeah.
You know, she was suffering terribly.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I that's the nature. I think when people, I don't have an addiction, so this isn't speaking from experience, but I feel that when people don't have an addiction, they feel like it's a choice for somebody else. A little bit like if you know someone who's anorexic, you think they're choosing not to eat.
No, it's the disease.
Yes. And I think that's something hopefully we're all getting better at understanding widely in society. Obviously, some people have known for a really long time, but we as a society treat people with addictions or those kind of diseases very poorly because we think they're doing it on purpose.
No.
Or all you have to do is not drink it or
no,
not take
not.
It. And exactly.
But it's, you know, it's the addiction that is making the choice for you.
Yes.
It's the illness that is making the choice for you.
Yeah.
It, you know, it's not you making that choice.
Yes. And so it's quite interesting because it intersects with sex work, because there's a big overlap and it can be quite a cyclical thing. It also overlaps with domestic violence quite a lot. And it makes certain people very difficult to help because, so I was doing some research into like intimate partner violence, and sometimes abusers will get people addicted to certain drugs. And if you're addicted to certain drugs or you need to get them, then lots of help is shut off from you, because the first thing you have to do is be clean, and now you are a worthy candidate or a candidate we feel qualified to help. And then we move on to the next stage. And so it's interesting that what exists in your book, which is there are people who are absolutely the most vulnerable in society. Like, we are supposed to be kind of supported by the state now. We don't have workhouses. But actually, if you can slip through the cracks because of... either because your work is criminalised or because you're addicted to a certain drug. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I think in many ways, you know, a lot of these problems that I identify in the book are still with us.
Yes.
They've taken on slightly different guise, but they're still there. Mm. And the interesting thing, I mean, addiction, as you mentioned, domestic violence is another one, homelessness.
Yes.
All of this stuff, you know, are things that women face as much as men.
Yeah.
And when women face it, it seems to be weirdly more invisible.
Yes. Well, it's an interesting thing with the stats on kind of current homelessness, because it's not that women... So there are more men sleeping rough than women by quite a large margin. But quite often that is actually to do with the fact that women can sell sex or some form of romantic relationship. And that goes all the way through from women dating to have places to stay or sex for rent, which is what they call it now. But actually there's always been a version of that going on, which is
exactly
if you'd be nice to somebody,
you
can have somewhere to stay. Men have much less ability. I know some men do sell, and especially, again, young, vulnerable men more likely to. But it's there's less of a market for them to be able to sell their bodies or their company.
But again, you know, that aspect of homelessness, as you've just described for women, is something which is invisible. Mm. We don't see it. It's hard to quantify it. And I think that's really interesting. You know, why is it that when women face a problem, it seems to be more complex and less visible?
Yes. Yeah.
In some cases.
I was going to ask you, maybe one last thing I'll ask you. One last thing, because William Steed is a very interesting figure in history.
Yeah.
Just interrupting the podcast here to clarify that we're talking about William Steed. I just mispronounced it as Stead. He was a Victorian journalist. He worked for the Pall Mall Gazette, and he was fascinated and horrified by the selling of young girls into the sex trade. He wrote The Maiden Tribute of Modern Babylon on the topic. It's thanks to the work of William Steed that the age of consent in the UK is 16 and not 13 as it was at the time.
And so William Steed, do you think he was a good guy or a bad guy?
Oh, that's so hard to say.
Yes.
I mean, I'm very seduced by his fascinating life.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah, I can't believe he died on the Titanic.
And died on the Titanic. I mean,
like,
what a way.
Like to drop the mic at the end.
Yeah, exactly. He died on the Titanic. You know, I mean, this guy lived the century.
Yes.
But, you know, his work was groundbreaking. Whether you believe that what he did to actually acquire that information was just or moral is another question.
So I was just going to describe a little bit. So William Steed is a journalist writing for the Pall Mall Gazette, and he has realised that going on in the underbellies of London, there's this terrible thing, which is not, as you would think, kind of empowered women choosing to sell sex. He's a bit more like someone who's like anti-trafficking, and he goes, these are kids and they're being tricked, and there are women enticers kind of meeting girls at Victoria Station saying, don't worry, I'll take your luggage. And then they're, you know, all these, well, kind of sold in a room against their knowledge, and then they're fallen women.
Yes. Well, that, but actually, you know, the interesting thing is, having done a lot of work on prostitution and sex work in the 18th century and looking at it in the 19th century, so many things hadn't changed.
Yes.
And those ruses hadn't changed.
Yes.
That was absolutely that. Factored into life in 18th century London as much as it did in the 19th century. I found what he wrote about sex trafficking really fascinating in the late 19th century because, you know, sex trafficking became a really, you know, an issue for the first time that people really looked at and addressed. And that largely had to do with improvements in technology of getting goods to market. It also meant you could get people as goods to market very quickly.
Okay.
So, you know, there were a number of articles which were written at the time and a number of scandals. Often these scandals surrounded girls who were servants who were tricked into by sex trafficking rings into being put into a maison close in Belgium or France, you know, locked up.
Yes.
And
it is what we would classically think of as trafficking.
As trafficking.
Yes. Yeah.
But the thing that Stead highlights, which I think is so interesting also, is that a lot of these women were in the sex trade already and went of their own volition. And I think that was the case with Mary Jane Kelly. You know, women knew that they were going to another house somewhere else, but somebody had probably told them they were going to be much better off, or a gentleman was going to be keeping them, and this, that, and the other. And then they get there and they find out that they can't get out. They're trapped. Because the whole way the Maison Close works is, you know, it's shuttered, it's closed, you're trapped in there. You know, the police are all in cahoots. And it's really hard to get out of a situation like that. It helps if you speak French, and a lot of these women didn't speak French.
Of course. And also there was a very clever way of kind of making women indebted to their house.
Yes.
So always, or again, addicted to a substance which they could only get there. Because one or those other things holding over your head, and actually you can't get any help and you can't go anywhere. It's not like you were given your money and you could save it up.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. You know, they always found some way of taking their cut. So you were always in debt.
Yeah.
First of all, they take away all of your clothes. You arrive with no belongings.
Yes.
Which is one of the reasons why I think Mary Jane Kelly was almost certainly trafficked into a maison close in Paris, because there was a whole issue when she returned about trying to get her clothes back from the madam she had lived with before.
Yeah.
So, you know, you arrive with no goods, then the madam gives you all this stuff to wear, and then suddenly you find that isn't free, and then you have to work it off. And then you never work it off, because she's always adding things to your tab.
Yeah, and of course your subsistence while you're there and everything and the overheads can all be changed, no matter, so you're always just under, just another week and you'll be on top of it.
Yeah,
and
it's sex slavery.
Yes, it is sex slavery. So William Stead, to talk about, so he wanted to prove how easy it was to procure an underage girl, didn't he?
Yes. It was a famous series of articles that he wrote called The Maiden Tribute to Modern Babylon. And so he went undercover and he managed to buy a child from a very poor woman and take her into a brothel. And of course, you know, she was drugged.
Yes.
And he said, well, look, see, it's completely possible to do that. But then he faced an enormous backlash.
Yeah, but that's interesting, because it goes exactly back to what we're talking about in terms of who owns women at a point where women were owned. Because the problem was that he had bought her from her mother, who had no right to sell her.
Yes.
She belonged to her father.
Yeah.
That was what the court case was. He didn't even buy her off her dad.
I know, for God's sake. Yeah.
He gave the money to a mother who, again, they said was alcoholic. And hence a really, really crazy time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, it didn't mean that stuff didn't happen.
No.
It happened all the time.
Yeah. But it's about where, I guess, this is in terms of the future, in terms of what's happening now, discussion about these kind of things, and then we started off talking about kind of legalization, is if someone's distaste for the fact that that's happening is to do with sex stigma, or thinking that women should be kept for their husbands, or that there's anything wrong with sex in general, it's really that kind of activism is really unhelpful. It has to kind of start from this base point of like, well, rape is a crime, sexual assault is a crime, selling sex isn't.
Yeah.
There are economic kind of coercions, but all of this kind of deconstruction, it can't come from a place of prudery. Of
yes.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. And that's the difficulty. But the question is, where does the prudery come from?
Yes.
Is that informed by historical precedents? Is that, you know, something that's been inculcated in us? You know, that is it morality? Is it personal preference? What is it?
Well, that's what's interesting in terms of different cultures having, because there are lots of things that are cross cultures, you know, like people don't like to go to the toilet in front of each other. People like to have sex in private. That's an evolved thing. Yeah, I think that's what part of the cultural conversation has to be about. If we have differences from country to country, let alone kind of tribe to tribe, then a lot of this is learned, which means excitingly changeable.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's positive.
It is positive. We've been to a positive place where we got very quickly from child sex trafficking to positivity. Thank you so much for coming
so
to speak
welcome.
To me. Thank you so much. Thank you so much to Hallie Rubenhold. Please seek out her book, The Five. It's absolutely fascinating and a brilliant read. This has been Sex, Power, Money with Sarah Pascoe. Next week, I'll be joined by comedian Sophie Duker and Dr. Annabelle Soamimo. Thank you for listening. This has been Sex, Power, Money with me, Sarah Pascoe. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please recommend it to your friends. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and give us a 5-star review so that other people can find it. Sex, Power, Money is also the name of my book that's sometimes been mentioned in the podcast. I'd love you to read it if you'd like to find out more and have your own discussions with your friends.